I'm Taylor Holbrooks, host of Morning Edition. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to keep going. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Tell your member of Congress you support WYPR by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org, and thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Before we begin today, an update on the police-involved shooting that took place on Pennsylvania Avenue last night. The man that was shot by police has died. He died at hospital this morning at about 11:15. The officer who was injured in that exchange of gunfire remains in fair condition in the hospital. The WYPR news team will continue to cover that story, so stay tuned. My guest today here on Midday is the author Michael Cannell. He's written the definitive biography of the architect I.M. Pei and a book about the first American to win the Grand Prix. He's also written books about the invention of criminal profiling and a 1940s mobster turned informant. His latest book returns to the topic of organized crime. It also includes profiles of numerous mobsters who turned on their former compatriots. The setting this time is Brooklyn, New York in the 1980s, and the central figures are not only mobsters, they're cops. The case of two decorated detectives, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa, made headlines when they were finally brought to justice in 2009, almost 30 years after a crime spree that included serving as informants and even hitmen for La Cosa Nostra. Others have written about these two corrupt cops, but Cannell's book sheds new light on this infamous story. It's called Blood and the Badge, The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. Michael Cannell joins us on Zoom from New York City. Mike, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a question that I started with, I think, the last time you were on the show. The last book you wrote was a book called A Brotherhood Betrayed. It was a few years ago. I'm interested in the very last line of this book, Blood and the Badge, in the acknowledgement section. You mentioned that your dad, Peter Cannell, and full disclosure, I know you and your family. I'm good friends of you and your wife, as well as your sister and brother-in-law, and I knew your folks, Peter and Ann, wonderful folks who are no longer with us. But it was your dad, you say, in this book, that encouraged you to write about gangsters. That's interesting. Why do you think he thought that was a good path for you to follow? Because you have certainly heeded that advice.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for saying that about my now late parents. My father, as you may know, Tom, was a really gifted writer just a natural writer who had five kids. And I think he always imagined that he would write a novel, and he never did. He went into the financial, with first the advertising and then the financial world to support his family, and not begrudgingly, he did that happily. But he was very interested in books, a real reader, and like I say, a natural writer, and he was very keenly interested in what I was doing in the journalism world. And as you mentioned, I wrote a book about an architect. I wrote about Grand Prix racing. And at a certain point, he said, you should write a book about gangsters. And at the time, I think I kind of laughed it off. It just seemed sort of random and not really my thing. And as I would say, as was often the case, he was exactly right, because over the course of three books about crime and two books about the mafia, I've discovered not just what a great font of stories and truly colorful characters that the underworld is, but also I've come to think of it as really an American story. I mean, just to talk about the mafia or write about the mafia is really to tell the American story. You might say it's the dark version. It's the dark American story. It's a story about assimilation, about getting ahead, about ascending in the American hierarchy, but it's the dark version of the Horatio Alger story.
There's this mythology that surrounds the mafia. The mafia is very popular in popular culture. I mean, if you think about movies like The Godfather or the Scorsese movies about mobsters, they're incredibly popular. There's this notion that somehow, the Marlon Brando characters that populate these stories are these noble, wise, sagacious elders who care about their communities and, love their families and are men of honor and can be trusted, to the hilt. None of that's true, actually, it seems to me. I mean, because in this book, you write about a whole panoply of people in La Cosa Nostra who are remorseless killers, and they're mean and they're mean-spirited, and they turn on their friends and others at the drop of a hat. So I wonder what do you attribute the fascination with organized crime and the fascination with the mafia in the public imagination? Where does it come from?
Yeah, Tom, I've thought about that a lot, and I wish I had a really definitive answer. I mean, here's what comes to my mind is you think about people in America going to movies in, say, the 1920s or 30s. A lot of those movies were westerns, right? That was right. So there was a kind of classic anti-hero, an American anti-hero, an outlaw who was breaking the law. He was committing crimes, but he was a heroic figure. And I think what happened is that during Prohibition, the late 20s and the 30s, that attraction to the anti-hero switched from the cowboy to the mafia figure, to the mafia boss. And I think it happened because Prohibition glamorized the mafia. So before Prohibition, these underworld characters were really kind of hated neighborhood thugs. But during Prohibition, they became very successful businessmen. They had to create networks. They had to smuggle liquor into the American cities, and they had to figure out how to distribute it. And they owned clubs and they owned restaurants. And in the public's mind, they were fulfilling a public service by keeping the liquor flowing. And so they were glamorized. And I think that idea of the underworld anti-hero just stayed with us from those
Yeah, it's
days.
interesting because I mean, perhaps it did get transferred from, the Billy the Kid characters
Yeah.
to Al Capone and Bonnie and Clyde and, John Dillinger, etc. It's interesting, these two guys that you write about, they are not your typical mafios members. They are, one of them's related by family to people in the mob, but he is a New York City policeman. And his partner, who doesn't have any familial relationship to the mob, is a willing accomplice in what they did. So these guys, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa, there have been a lot of books written about these two. A lot of folks have, this is a celebrated case. It's a very dark chapter in the history of the New York City Police Department, to be sure. Why did you want to take up a pretty familiar story like this, which was at the time of their trial. They were indicted in 2005. They got sentenced in 2009. There's lots and lots of press coverage of it. It was a national story. What made you want to dig even deeper into this story?
Well, my publisher had the exact same question when I proposed this book. It has been written about a fair amount, as you say. I guess my response is that a couple of books were written about it. They were really incomplete. I thought incomplete in the sense that they were not very thorough, and incomplete in the sense that they were completed before the story had reached its conclusion. And something else, another reason, which is that a little bit, by the time I came along, a little bit of time had passed. And, you know, it's different telling a story after some time has passed. It's just different when something is a story or events are kind of passing into history rather than current events. And I would say that I don't think that the people in this story would have spoken to me 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but they did speak to me now. And that is really the difference, is that the FBI agents, the DEA agents, the detectives, the lawyers, in a couple of cases, the actual mafia figures, they almost without exception completely opened up to me. And so waiting a little bit, I think, made a really big difference. And these are people who would never have spoken before. In some cases, detectives who had never even told their families about the cases that they were working on. And they're now retired. They're in their early 80s or late 70s. And just when they started to tell me the stories, I mean, it's just jaw-dropping. I mean, it's like one Netflix series after another.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, as they reach, you know, the final years of their lives, they had some things maybe they needed to be unburdened of. And the story is really incredible right to the very end of it, the very moment of the sentencing of these two guys. Let's talk a little bit about the two central characters, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa. And by the way, let me remind folks that you are Michael Cannell, the author of Blood and the Badge, The Mafia and Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. I'm Tom Hall, and it's Midday. So these guys, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa. Let's start with Detective Eppolito. What can you tell us about him to sort of set the scene for his temperament and his situation as he got involved.
I mean, as you know, Tom, he is. It's almost hard to believe that he existed in real life. He seems like a fabrication from Hollywood. He was, as you mentioned, he was born into a mafia family. His father was a capo in the Gambino crime family. His father was known as Fat the Gangster. And his uncle was also a capo, and he was known as Jimmy the Clam. And not surprisingly, Fat the Gangster was a kind of violent and abusive character. And weeks after Fat the Gangster died, his son, Louis, rebelled against his father and the family by joining the New York City Police Department. Now, his family and his friends just couldn't believe that he would do that. I mean, it was just an unthinkable act of rebellion against the family.
And was it assumed that he was headed for a similar career like his father and uncle?
Yeah, I mean, his father had brought him up inculcated in the traditional Sicilian values of organized crime. And I think it was assumed that he would, in some capacity, carry on his father's legacy, at the very least not go over to the enemy side, at the very least not change teams. But he did, and he became a He became a decorated detective. He became a lauded detective. But as is often the case in life, he couldn't escape his family, and he teamed up with Stephen Caracappa. They were assigned as partners in a unit called Brooklyn Robbery South. And they were involved, as many cops were in those days. They were involved in kind of medium level corruptions, but they eventually found a patron in the Lucchese crime family who paid them a retainer of $4,000 a month. And for that sum, they forwarded to the mafia sensitive FBI and police information: who was under surveillance, who was under investigation, who was about to be arrested, but most importantly, who in the mafia ranks was a rat. In other words, who in the mafia ranks was secretly cooperating with law enforcement. And then they were paid a bonus to facilitate the murder of those informants. So they were involved in varying degrees and abductions, in more than a dozen murders and abductions. And this went on for a long time. I mean, this went on for more than a decade.
And the two of them couldn't be more unlike when it came to their demeanor, to their countenance, to their physicality. Louis Ippolito, a very heavy guy. Stephen Caracappa, pencil thin. He's very Caracappa, very quiet, a kind of a homebody, sticks to himself, doesn't do a lot of talking. Ippolito, a very, gregarious, effusive guy. They were sort of Mutt and Jeff. I know you recount that when they were first paired with each other, Caracappa went to his boss and said, "I can't work with this guy, I don't want to do it." But whatever friction they had initially certainly dissipated, and they were able to, have a very close relationship. They remained close for the rest of their lives. I mean, when they retired, Caracappa bought a house across the street from Ippolito in Las Vegas. What do you make of that, the differences in personality and temperament between the two, and how that may or may not have contributed to what they were able to do on behalf of the mafia?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's like a lot of successful partnerships. They were opposite in every way, as you said. I mean, I think I compare them in the book to Laurel and Hardy. Ippolito, as you've said, was a heavy set, boorish, loudmouth, bullying character, and Caracappa was silent to the point of being almost mute, but circumspect and watchful. They were assigned to work together, as we've said, and somehow discovered in each other this mutual inclination to not just commit petty corruptions, but to commit the most unthinkable kind of crimes a detective could commit. And yes, they really got away with this until they didn't, and then they collected their generous police pensions and retired to Las Vegas, where, as you mentioned, Caracappa bought a house across the street from Ippolito. He may have bought that house because they were closest of friends. I suspect that he bought it in part because they had committed this long series of heinous crimes, and Caracappa was worried that Ippolito would make a blunder, that he would give them away. And so he was, I'm pretty sure he was there in part to keep watch over Ippolito.
And we'll talk more about these two guys, as well as this long list of characters with whom they conspired. Michael Cannell, his latest book is called Blood and the Badge, The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. We'll have more with Michael Cannell on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow on the Juneteenth edition of Midday, a provocative book rejects some of the long-held tenets of the fight for civil rights, arguing that black opposition to white supremacy can take many more forms than might be commonly assumed. I'll speak with Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, a professor at Wellesley College, about her book, We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. So that's coming up tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is the author Michael Cannell. We're talking about his latest book, Blood and the Badge, The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Mike, when it comes to the motivation that these guys had to commit these crimes, you mentioned that Eppolito came from a mob family. Was he being pressured in his early years with the police department to, having done this, horrible iconoclastic move of switching over to the other side and working as a cop? But was he getting a lot of pressure? Was it dissatisfaction with the department? Was it just the money? How do you read the reasons that he was apparently so easily persuaded to involve himself in this kind of activity?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Tom. I mean, when he was working as a cop and later as a detective, he was obliged by police regulations to keep distance between himself and any criminal elements. He was in a restaurant with his wife one day, and one of his father's old associates in the mafia came over, kissed him on both cheeks in the mafia manner, paid for their meal. He began to visit his uncle, and his uncle would slip him envelopes of cash, and he began to do favors for his family and friends. So on some level, he was just simply seduced back into it. I think it's more complicated than that, though. I think Eppolito was somebody who never really knew if he was a mafiosi masquerading as a detective or if he was a detective masquerading as a mafiosi. I think he wanted it both ways, and it was all kind of confused in his mind. I mean, one thing I will mention is that when he joined the police department, he found that the old mafia techniques of threat and violence and coercion actually worked pretty well in South Brooklyn in a police uniform. So I think in his mind, it was also there maybe wasn't that much difference between the two. And in some ways, the police department, particularly in those days, isn't that different. I mean, they're both very hierarchical. They both kind of reward on some kind of instinct for violence. So, I think it was all kind of confused in his mind. I think his friend Caracappa was an entirely different character. I asked a detective once who worked with Caracappa in in what's called the Major Case Squad, an elite, the most, really the most elite unit in the police department. Why do you think Karakappa committed these crimes? And the detective who knew him well said, "For money, of course." But I'm not really convinced that that's true. I think Karakappa was committing these crimes in part because he felt the need for some kind of a secret life. I think he got some fulfillment or gratification for pulling one over on people. He seemed to be obsessed with the mafia language and would use mafia language to a conspicuous degree in the Major Case Squad. I spoke to a DEA agent who trailed him in Las Vegas for months, and he mentioned to me that on a couple of occasions when he was following Caracappa around, he locked eyes with Caracappa. They had eye contact. And the DEA agent said it was just chilling. There was something about his demeanor that was just so menacing. And so I don't know, I think Caracappa was just I think he was just attracted to these dangerous and illicit activities.
It's interesting because, the two of them were involved in things that obviously required them to keep very secret. They had all of these assignments that involved killing people themselves, causing others to be killed because of information they were passing along to the mafia. But Ippolito, in particular, had a real aspiration to be a famous public figure. He had roles in television and movies. He wrote a book. I think he called it Mafia Cop. It was obviously very different than your book, given his recounting of his career as a police officer. He was on the Sally Jesse Raphael show that some of our listeners will remember, plugging his book. He really wanted to be a public figure in the context of or at the same time that he was doing all these secretive things. It just the psychological gymnastics that he had to go through were really quite astonishing.
Right. I mean, again, it's so interesting that these two were different, right? I mean, Caracappa really just kind of disappeared into the room. And Ippolito, his closest friend, was the opposite. He wanted forever to be the loudest, most conspicuous person in the room. And what that meant was that after they moved to Las Vegas, he launched what he imagined would be a movie career for himself as an actor and a director. And in fact, he was in about a dozen movies, small roles, cameo roles. Most conspicuously, he had a cameo in Goodfellas. As you mentioned, he did write a book. If you had committed these crimes, you would think that you would keep your mouth shut. You would think that you would be quiet, but he just couldn't. His impulse to attract attention was just too strong, and he wrote this book. Of course, in the book, he didn't describe any of the crimes that he had committed on behalf of the mafia, but it ultimately did lead to his undoing.
Yeah, there's a photograph in that book of Ippolito and Caracappa, and there were a bunch of people within the mafia who had worked with them but never had met them in person. But because that photograph was published, they were able to identify who it was. We have an email from a listener, Tom, who says this is a great topic. The mafia had its ascendancy during the Depression and Prohibition when economic desperation was widespread and there was no social safety net. And people from Sicily faced social bias very similar to Jim Crow. So it's understandable that patriarchal characters like Marlon Brando were forgiven as people focused on the mafia's employment opportunities and charity. And Tom goes on to say, this helps explain the current blatant corruption at the federal level today. Defunding the IRS and the SEC opens doors for self-dealing and tax evasion by the very wealthy. So Tom draws a lineage between this kind of, you know, organized crime activity and what's going on at the federal level. My guest is Michael Cannell. His new book is called Blood and the Badge, The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. So, Mike, let's talk about some of the other characters, and there are dozens and dozens. I lost track, you know, in the course of reading this book. There are so many people who had interactions with Eppolito and Caracappa. And another central figure in the book is a guy named Anthony Casso. His nickname was Gaspipe. And he called Caracappa and Eppolito his crystal ball because they were able to enlighten him about what the police and the FBI, et cetera, were up to. This is a particularly heinous, violent, horrible man.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this about Gaspipe. I think most people in La Cosa Nostra are soldiers, and they follow the orders, and they are oddly risk averse. They don't want to take risks. They're not reckless. They plan things very carefully, and they kill when they have to. But there's another part of the mafia which is like they're like serial killers. They're like sociopaths, and they enjoy the violent part of it. And Gaspipe Casso fits very squarely into that part. I encourage people to Google Ed Bradley's interview with Gaspipe Casso in Supermax prison. You know, it was aired on 60 Minutes many years ago, but it's chilling to see it. This is a really, truly menacing person, and he was the patron. He was Eppolito and Caracappa's patron. He was an underboss of the Lucchese crime family. He was the one who employed them and drew from them all of the information that he could, and also doled out assignments to them for abductions and killings.
I want to put this in what they were doing in the historical context, because you remind us that in the mid-1970s, there was a horrible fiscal crisis in the city of New York. There was that famous headline, you know, White House to New York, drop dead, or something along those lines. And one of the things that was greatly affected was the budget of the police department. So there was a huge downturn. More than 5,000 people left the department. So they were down 5,000 officers. They had 4 years where they had no recruits whatsoever. There was nobody in the police academy, and there was historic levels of crime. So it's out of that era that these two crooked cops started working and started, you know, cooperating with organized crime. So were there other examples, you know, that perhaps didn't rival these two in terms of the severity and the frequency of what they were doing, but was the entire obviously the department was demoralized, if nothing else, but did corruption grow as rampantly as the crime was growing on the streets of New York itself?
Yeah, well, I mean, Eppolito and Caracappa's activities came in the wake of really well-publicized police corruption in New York City. The Knapp Commission investigated corruption and was deeply not just disturbing, but really kind of shook the core of law enforcement in New York. And then, of course, people, I think, know the story of Serpico. And so Eppolito and Caracappa came along in the wake of those episodes, and I think that accounts in part for why they got away with it. At one point, the New Jersey State Police and the FBI raided the home of a Sicilian heroin dealer, importing heroin, His name was Rosario Gambino. He was part of the Gambino crime family. They raided his home in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and to their astonishment, they found that Gambino had a copy of his own police file in his home. So how did he get it? They found that Eppolito's fingerprints were on it. So, of course, Eppolito went before internal affairs. His case was dismissed, amazingly. I mean, they had him dead to rights, but they threw the case out. Not only that, not only did they throw the case out, but they promoted him to detective second grade, and they invited him to pick whatever police precinct he wanted to work in. And of course, he picked a precinct right in Bensonhurst, right in the heart of mafia country. So why did the police department do that? I think they did it because they just were trying to avoid more bad publicity. I think that Benjamin Ward, who was then the police commissioner, just simply decided that they were not going to have any more embarrassing headlines.
The book is Blood and the Badge: The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. The author is my guest, Michael Cannell. We'll have more with Mike Cannell on the other side of a quick break. We'll talk about how this enterprise eventually came tumbling down. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is the author Michael Cannell. He's a former editor at the New York Times. He's written for The New Yorker, Newsweek, Time, Sports Illustrated, many other publications as well. He's also written five books, the latest of which is Blood and the Badge: The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. It's about two horribly corrupt and murderous New York detectives who were not held accountable for their crimes in the 1980s until 2009. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780 or email us midday at wypr.org. We have an email from Charlotte. Could you ask the author if he would look into the Russian mafia in U.S. and elsewhere? The book Red Mafia by Friedman is very eye-opening. One of the characters that you profile in this book, Mike, is a guy named Bert Kaplan, who was, you know, not Italian, so not part of the families, the Gambinos, the Lucchesis, etc. Turned out to be a very significant figure in this story. Are there, you know, very hard and fast lines between, you know, the Russian mafia, the Irish mafia, the Italian mafia, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, there are. I mean, if you want to become what's called a made man in the Italian mafia, a made man really essentially means that you are a member of the mafia, and you have to commit a murder to be a made man, and you have to be sponsored. And there's a kind of almost medieval ceremony, induction ceremony. You can't do that if you're not of Italian descent, or at least your mother must be of Italian descent. So the Italian mafia, the five families, as they're called, of New York, ran concurrently with mafias of other ethnicities. The Russian mafia came on in the 60s and 70s, and the Irish mafia, which by then was really located in Hell's Kitchen, west of Times Square. These different groups cooperated and fought with each other in turn. People often ask me, what is the state of the mafia today? And my answer is the Italian mafia is still out there. If you, I, we could drive out today to Bensonhurst, and the wise guys would still be out there. They're still doing gambling operations and protection rackets. But they're not menacing in the way that they were before, I don't think. I asked a detective once why that was, and he said a lot of it simply comes down to the proliferation of security cameras. It's hard to shoot somebody or abduct somebody on the street and not get caught because of the security cameras. I don't know really anything about the Russian mafia, but I am going to guess that the Russian mafia, which is based in the Brighton Beach neighborhood of Brooklyn, I'm going to guess that they're engaged in the kind of violent activities that the Italian mafia was up to in previous decades.
I'm interested about the term mafia. You enlightened me in this book that it was used by one of the people whose profile rose considerably because of his prosecutions of the mafia, and that's Rudolph Giuliani. He had put eight sort of old guard mafia leaders in what was known as the Commission case in jail. And he was the first person to start using the term mafia, which had been banned by the Department of Justice since 1970. And that's fascinating. And you even report that Francis Ford Coppola didn't use that term in The Godfather. Why was it banned? And how did Giuliani, who is himself of Italian descent, get away with reintroducing it?
Well, yeah, the La Cosa Nostra, which is the term that the mafia itself used. The mafia itself didn't ever really use the term mafia. They used the term La Cosa Nostra, which translates as our thing. And in the 70s, they formed what you could plausibly be called a kind of anti-defamation league. And so they leaned on Francis Ford Coppola not to use the term mafia in The Godfather. So if you watch The Godfather, interestingly, you'll never hear that term. Giuliani came in the 80s as a federal prosecutor in New York, and possibly because he was himself of Italian descent, he had a slightly different posture about these things, and he called the mafia the mafia.
Let's talk a little bit about the RICO laws. You tell us about a guy who is the chief counsel for the Senate Subcommittee on Criminal Laws and Procedures. He was a law professor, a guy named G. Robert Blakely, who devised this notion of conspiracy for the RICO laws. And one of the tenets of that particular legal approach is that you had to prove that there was an ongoing conspiracy. And this became a complication in the prosecution of Eppolito and Caracappa. Tell us a little bit about how the way RICO was set up made things difficult for the prosecutors.
Yeah, when I knew that I was in this book that I was going to have to explain the RICO laws, and it felt to me at first like a kind of obligation. How am I going to wade through this legalese in the book? But it didn't take me very long to figure out that the RICO laws are just really fascinating. Blakey wrote these RICO laws because law enforcement had no problem grabbing the street soldiers in the mafia, but they could never get the bosses. It goes back to that kind of funny story about Al Capone being convicted of tax evasion. They had to convict him of tax evasion because they couldn't get him on anything else, because he didn't ever pull the trigger. He just told somebody else to pull the trigger. So G. Robert Blakey wrote this law And his idea was anybody who was involved in a criminal conspiracy is liable for whatever crime results from that conspiracy. And this was groundbreaking, but nobody paid any attention to it. And for a decade, these laws were on the books and nobody used them until Giuliani came along. And for whatever reason, Giuliani recognized the value of the RICO laws, and he used them, as you mentioned, to bust the top tier of the mafia in what's called the commission case. The RICO laws were applied to Eppolito and Caracappa, but with a wrinkle. I mean, there was a statute of limitations, right, of 5 years. And Eppolito and Caracappa had moved to Las Vegas, and they weren't really doing these activities anymore on behalf of the mafia. But they were encouraged to sell drugs to a contact who was purportedly sort of their financial advisor and an accountant, and he was helping Eppolito raised money for the movies he wanted to make. In fact, he was an undercover agent, and so this undercover operative said some producers are coming to Las Vegas and they want a party and they want to buy some meth. And so Eppolito arranged for his son to help them buy meth, and this as a crime that would reset the clock on the statute of limitations. They were tried, they were convicted.
And we're having trouble here as we finish up our conversation with Mike Cannell with our Zoom connection. We apologize for that. If we get Mike back in our last minute here, I want to talk to him about some of the victims of the crimes that Eppolito and Caracappa committed. There was one guy, a guy named Barry Gibbs, who was wrongfully accused of a murder that, in fact, was a mafia murder, not a murder that Mr. Gibbs created. He did receive a nearly $10 million settlement, which was at the time, this is in 2010, the largest personal payout in the city's history. All in all, the city paid about $18.5 million to settle various lawsuits for the families of people who had been victims of the mafia hits and the various crimes and stuff. So, Mike, I'm sorry we're having trouble with your thing because we're basically out of time, but I do want to congratulate you on the book. It's fascinating. There's an incredible twist in the trial at the end, which we'll save for people to read the book and find out about. But congratulations and thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
Michael Cannell, we have been talking about his latest book, Blood and the Badge: The Mafia, Two Killer Cops, and a Scandal That Shocked the Nation. So that's it for us today. Tomorrow, on the Juneteenth edition of Midday, my guest will be Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson. We'll talk about her latest book, We Refuse: A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Fresh Air is up next after news, so stick around for that. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.